Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Well, in the next few weeks, Senator Bernie Sanders is expected to decide if he'll run for president. If he does run, Sanders told members of the National Press Club this week that the top issue in his campaign will be the growing gap of income inequality in this country.
I am absolutely convinced that the struggle for economic and social justice, the struggle for a strong middle class, the struggle for a vibrant democracy in which elections are not bought by the wealthy will not be won in our lifetime unless an unprecedented grassroots movement is developed which is prepared to take on and defeat the power of the 1%.
So what are the major factors that will influence Sanders' decision? This is just one of many issues we'll discuss today with our guest, Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator, welcome back to Vermont Edition. It's great to have you here.
Good to be with you, Bob.
You can join the conversation here at Vermont Edition. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. Maybe you have some thoughts about Senator Sanders running for president. Is it a good idea? Would you support his campaign? What are some of the big issues that you think Congress should be focused on this winter? What are your thoughts about the United States and how it should deal with the terrorist group ISIS? Should a limited number of U.S. troops be sent to Iraq and Syria to help defeat ISIS? Or would that be a big mistake? And the Federal Highway Trust Fund is going to run out of money in several months. Should Congress consider raising the gas tax to bring some long-term stability to the trust fund? 1-800-639-2211 is our phone number. You can always send us an email at vermontedition@vpr.net. Better still, give us a call. 1-800-639-2211. Senator Sanders, there was an article in Politico this morning about your possible presidential bid, and the first paragraph is this. This is a direct quote. Bernie Sanders hasn't made any big hires for a potential presidential run. He doesn't have the money he needs for a campaign. He isn't sure he can raise it. And he's already sick about hearing about Hillary Clinton. This is not a guy who's ready for 2016. Is that a fair assessment?
No, it's not a fair assessment. I think the media is a little bit angry inside the Beltway that I have not taken the many, many opportunities they have provided me to attack Hillary Clinton. They think that that is one of the great issues facing America. Hillary's emails and the need to rip her apart. And I have respectfully declined to do that because based on the calls that I'm getting in Vermont, what I hear from people all over the country, that ain't one of the major issues facing America. It's a media issue. And I think that sometimes rubs some of the inside the Beltway media the wrong way. Also, media likes never-ending long campaigns. I don't think the American people do like that. So I am giving, as you have heard me say a million times when asked, thought to running for president because I think the problems facing this country are so extraordinary in terms of a collapsing middle class, huge gaps between the very, very rich and everybody else, unemployment, which is unacceptably high, and the fact that we have a Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court, which allows billionaires to dominate our political process, not to mention what the scientific community tells us that climate change is the great environmental crisis facing our planet. So the issues are out there. They need to be debated. I think the American people want candidates to speak up for working class Americans. And that's why I'm giving thought to running.
So do you think those issues will be addressed if you choose not to run?
Well, Bob, you're asking a great question. And by the way, I hope that listeners, you know, whether they agree with me or not, will get on the phone and call us up. This is my fear. I'll give you some examples about this. And it's not just the politicians. It is the media as well. There was a study that came out a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, from a group that analyzes what's on network television. The TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement, is the largest trade agreement in the history of the United States. It is of enormous consequence. Do you know how much time network television has given to the TPP? Do you know how much? Zero. Not a minute. How does that happen? You're looking, last year we had to send a letter to the presidents of the major networks saying, you got to talk about climate change. Virtually no discussion about climate change. I held a press conference yesterday with the leadership of the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare. We talked about 2 million people signing a petition that says to Congress, don't cut Social Security. Do you know how much coverage that got? Virtually nothing at all. Citizens United decision, the worst Supreme Court decision in modern history of this country, allowing the Koch brothers and billionaires to buy election. You know how much coverage it gets on television? Almost nothing. Hillary Clinton, on the other hand, my God, I can't literally walk down the hallways of the Senate without getting bombarded about Hillary. How does that happen? So the question that you're asking is, can we force debate about the real issues that people in Vermont and around this country feel are important? And that's a good question. I'm not sure that I know the answer to that.
Well, I'm also wondering if you feel confident if you don't run, and there are a whole host of issues that you say you'd like to bring up on a national scale. If you choose not to run, do you think other presidential candidates will bring those issues up and debate them?
There's a real chance that those issues will not in a significant way be brought up. And that's one of the reasons that motivates me to run. And the other issue that motivates me is in this last election, you had 63% of the American people not voting, 80% of young people not voting. I think there is real disillusionment with the political process. People are very alienated from the political process. They think that big money controls what's going on. They don't think that it's possible that we can bring about the change that we need. And I don't want to see that happen.
So how much money do you think you'd need? As it sounds like right now what you're doing is going around and trying to gauge grassroots support, not only in Vermont, but in New Hampshire, in Iowa, other states of the country. What do you have to see in order to feel like, because you said at the National Press Club this week, you're not going to do it unless you can do it right, unless you can do it well.
Right.
So what do you need to see in order to feel good about doing it?
Well, you need two things. You need two things, and that's what we're trying to ascertain. And I know some people, the political writer there, is not happy that I haven't moved as fast as he would like me to move, but let him run for president and see what happens. Number one, we are looking, because of Citizens United, at the ability of folks like the Koch brothers and others to spend unlimited sums of money. And the Koch brothers themselves are worth $100 billion, so they can spend billions of dollars and not know the difference. I was thinking, Bob, and it was just kind of this epiphany that hit me a few weeks ago. I said, okay, if I do really, really well, just really unprecedentedly, better than Obama, and we get 3 million people to contribute $100 each, you know what that is? That's $300 million. Now, in Vermont, we think $300 million, that's just an unbelievable sum of money, right? That is one-third of what the Koch brothers themselves say that they're going to spend on the campaign. That's just what they say. They may double that amount of money. So you're talking about huge sums. So that's issue number one. How do we raise money? And, you know, number two is there a willingness? And I want people to call up. Tell me yes, tell me no. Don't agree with me. Is there a willingness for people to get actively involved in the political process? And the answer is there's a lot of anger out there. There's a lot of frustration. But are people willing to roll up their sleeves and get involved in an unprecedented grassroots campaign? And, you know, I've been in many parts of this country. There's a lot of support out there. But can we bring the hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people we need to get involved? Don't know the answer to that yet.
You know, we've got the possibility of Hillary Clinton running for the Democratic nomination, Jeb Bush running for the Republican nomination. Do you, as you've traveled around, do you get a sense that there's some fatigue out there with Bush and Clinton, and maybe it's time for a fresh face to be on the scene?
The answer is, yeah, I do. But on top of that, I think people are saying we got 320 million people in this country. You got a lot of very smart people, a lot of very energetic people. How does it happen that the only major candidates turn out to be perhaps the spouse of a former president and the brother and son of a former president? What does that tell us? And, you know, I think it tells us a lot. So to answer your question, yes, is the short answer.
So what does your gut tell you right now? Are you going to do it?
Well, if I knew it, I would say it, but I don't. It's just one of these things that I know some people. But, you know, it's I get tired of hearing the question because I will do it or not do it. When I have reached the conclusion that I need to reach, it is a mammoth undertaking. And as I've said before, and you've paraphrased me correctly, it's not just about my ego. It is I will be carrying the banner for many millions of Americans who want to see action taken on income and wealth inequality, who want to see millions of jobs being created, who want to make sure their kids can afford to go to college, who believe in health care for all, who want to deal with climate change. Those are enormously important issues to tens of millions of Americans. And if I carry that banner on my shoulders, it has to be done well. And if I falter through my own limitations, people will say, oh, you see, these issues aren't important. No one really cares about climate change. No one really worries that the rich are getting richer and everybody else is getting poor. See, Anders ran, and he didn't do very well. So that's the pressure that's on me. It's not just my own ego, Bob.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Bradley, who's calling from Waterbury. Hey, Bradley, welcome to the program.
Hi, Bernie. I've always voted for you, and I think you're the only level-headed candidate I've ever seen. And I think you should run for president. And it makes it very hard for you to work with a racist Congress that is down there now. So I hope things will change if you ran.
Well, Bradley, thank you. Thank you very much for your support. And clearly, I mean, Bradley's view of what goes on in Congress and the obstructionism that goes on, the inability to deal with the real issues facing the American people, I think he's speaking for a whole lot of folks in this country.
Let's talk to Edna, who's calling from Peru. Hi, Edna. What's on your mind today?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
Oh, thank you. Hi, Bernie. I met you at a festival up in Montpelier at one point. We came together with the Vermont Farm and Food Coalition and made huge changes in Vermont on the agricultural issues and impoverished farmers here. And that was in the early 1990s with Vermont Farm and Food Coalition. And I am totally behind you. I do agree with Bradley that you are so logical, and I really appreciate that you have been speaking out for the common people of this country. And I think it's time we take the country back. And, you know, I've been really excited about you running for president, and I would love to get behind that and help you to raise money. I thought we could use a similar plan to the Vermont Farm and Food Coalition, which went on local grassroots movement to get farmers and people that were affected by the agricultural plight of Vermont in the early 90s. And we've had a huge organic thrust because of that. Many farmers markets have opened up, and we could use that same system to get money together and start locally. And I also would love to see you in the presidency because of all of the unethical things that have been done. And to think about another Bush running, I'm sorry, but I think the mess that we're in, the gas prices, the cost of heating, Iraq, should have never been involved with what happened with 9/11. And there are just so many things I could go on about. So I would love to just hear you speak to that and also your plan for raising money.
Okay, Edna, thank you very much. Howard Dean certainly showed when he ran for president in 2004 the power of the Internet. Yes. Is that something you would try to harness as well?
Yes, absolutely, of course. I mean, but let me just thank Edna for the work that she and the many others in Vermont agriculture have done. I think in many ways we're leading the country. It gives me just tremendous pride to drive around the state on a given Saturday and see the just the farmers markets all over this state, to see good quality food getting into our schools, raising nutrition consciousness. We're making some real progress because of people like Edna. And so I just want to thank her very much. No, Howard did certainly show the power of the Internet, and the Internet has advanced significantly since that point. So in a lot of ways, not just money, but in terms of communicating with people. Bob, right now, we have on our website, our Senate website, sanders.senate.gov, our Facebook now has some 900,000 people who receive our communications. And we have hundreds of thousands of people who receive our emails. And the beauty of that is, you know, frankly, you can communicate directly with people. You don't have to go around the cynicism of the inside the beltway mentality. So no question, Internet is where it's at to a significant degree.
One last question about this before we move on to some of the issues before Congress. It's known that you're thinking about should you, if you decide to run, should you run as a Democrat, should you run as an independent? If you run as a Democrat, you have the opportunity to be in debates that will get a fair amount of media attention. Getting on the ballot as an independent in all 50 states is very time-consuming and very expensive. And then, finally, if you run as an independent candidate, you run the risk of being Ralph Nader, and you've said all along that's something you really don't want to do. So if you do run, isn't it pretty likely that you'd run as a Democrat?
Well, I don't want to speculate it. You've given the advantages and disadvantages. The only other issue out there is I think there is the truth is running as an independent would require a whole lot of money and energy and time. And in some cases, by the way, it may be impossible. In some states, I think North Carolina and elsewhere, the system is so stacked in favor of the two-party system, it may literally be impossible to get on the ballot. The only other point that I would throw out is there is massive discontent with both political parties right now. And you're seeing all over this country more and more people, you know, thinking about what Vermonters thought about many years ago when they elected me to Congress as an independent, that they want to go outside the two-party system. So, but you've hit on the pluses and minuses of both.
Let's talk to Aaron, who's calling from Bennington. Hey, Aaron, welcome to the program.
Hello. Good afternoon. My question for Mr. Sanders is that, can you hear me?
We sure can.
Yeah. Okay. Is that he's talking about finance and how raising money in the Koch brothers and how they can just stack up the field. I think all candidates should only accept public finance. That way it can level the playing field, and it'll give more people opportunity to run for those positions. If we get good candidates, we get people who can come up with better ideas, we can make this change for this country. And that's my question.
And my answer is I agree with you, Aaron. You're absolutely right. I believe in public funding of elections. I think it does two things. It limits the amount of money that any candidate can spend, so you don't have a situation where the Koch brothers can buy elections. And as you also indicated, it allow anybody, you know, working class people, middle class people who are not rich, who don't have rich benefactors, the opportunity to participate in the political process and get their ideas out, no matter, you know, whether they're progressive, conservative, whatever they may be. So I absolutely agree with you, and I am strongly supportive of public funding of elections.
But even if you had public financing, couldn't the Koch brothers still make independent expenditures?
Yes, under current law right now.
Today in the program, our guest is Senator Bernie Sanders. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. When we come back, we're going to take a look at some of the big issues facing the Senate. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. Our guest today is Senator Bernie Sanders. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's look at the budget. You're the ranking minority member on the Senate Budget Committee. That panel will begin marking up a bill next week. The goal is to have some legislation considered by the end of the month. On the Senate floor this week, this is what you had to say about the budget choices facing your committee.
A budget is about priorities. A budget is about choices. And what we have got to determine is whether our budget coming out of the Senate is a budget that represents the needs of the rich and large corporations and their wealthy campaign donors, or whether we produce a budget which represents the needs of working families and the middle class and the millions and millions of families that are struggling economically to keep their heads above water.
Now, one of your ideas has been a huge infrastructure bill that would employ several million people in the transportation sector, certainly the construction sector. Is this bill going to be considered by the Budget Committee?
A modified form of it will be, yes. I wanted to put $1 trillion over a five-year period into rebuilding our infrastructure, which I think, as most Americans know, is really crumbling. And that's not just roads and bridges, it's water systems, it's wastewater plants, it is dams, it is levees, it is airports, it is making sure that broadband gets to rural areas all over this country. The American Society of Civil Engineers tells us that we have to invest some $3 trillion. So we proposed a $1 trillion over a five-year period. And what that would do, Bob, is create and sustain about 13 million decent-paying jobs. And it would transform America in a huge way, giving a state-of-the-art infrastructure rather than decades-old infrastructure. We are way behind Europe, way behind Japan, way behind China in rail, for example. So we can make huge progress in making the country more efficient and productive and creating jobs. So in our budget, it will not go as far as I personally want to go, but there will be a significant language for infrastructure improvement.
And how would that be paid for?
The way it would be paid for and the way we should be paying for most of the needs of America is to address the fact that right now we have a tax system heavily geared in favor of the wealthy and large corporations. The last study that I saw showed that one out of four large corporations, profitable corporations, pay nothing in federal income taxes. You have major companies like General Electric, Verizon, Boeing, very profitable corporations that in any given year recently not only pay nothing, they actually got a rebate from the IRS. We're losing about $100 billion a year because companies and the very wealthy stashing their money in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and other tax havens. I think you begin to address that issue, we start bringing in substantial amounts of revenue that we can invest in infrastructure and other needs.
So what are the chances that the Republican-controlled budget committee is going to put this in as part of the final budget plan?
Well, they certainly will not put what I want in. Hopefully, they will have some money going to infrastructure. Look, again, I don't mean to be terribly partisan here, but the fact of the matter is you have a Republican Party now, which is extremely right-wing, whose job is to represent the wealthy and the powerful. So I'm not staying up nights being optimistic. They're going to ask their campaign donors to start paying their fair share of taxes.
Let's talk to Alan, who's calling from Newport. Hey, Alan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Senator Sanders, I'd like to thank you for all the work you've done for the seniors, for the farmers, and for the veterans. And I know that you're the fighter for them, and you've always supported them. And I think if you run for president, many people will come behind and push you along and work hard to see you win, because we need a new face in our government. We need someone that can speak out and is not afraid, and you've demonstrated that all your life. So I think you would be an ideal candidate.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for those kind words. And you know, one of the areas, obviously, that I have focused on in recent years as the former chairman of the Veterans Committee is the needs of our veterans. And I'm proud that in a bipartisan way, one of the few major pieces of bipartisan legislation that we got passed last session, we did pass a major veterans bill.
Let's talk to Michael, who is calling, I believe, from Massachusetts. Hi, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. This is a real treat. I'm driving to Northampton, and I just happened to listen to NPR, and it's a pleasure to speak with Senator Sanders. As a U.S. citizen, you know, I've never voted for you up in Vermont, but I would vote for you as president. You seem to have a good handle on many of the issues that we're facing as a country. And you know, I mean, campaign finance reform, term limits, taxing the wealthy their fair share, all of these things. The one thing about the middle class that we, you know, and the disparity between incomes that we often overlook is the cost of energy. And as we grapple with the Keystone Pipeline and things like that, I install solar systems, so I'd like to say that right up front. I believe this country, if we had started down the road of renewable energy seriously back at the first oil embargo of 1973, a lot of the issues that we're seeing in this day and age wouldn't have existed. You know, and I was adamantly opposed to the Keystone Pipeline. And I've been following what's been going on down there. And I've come to the conclusion that maybe we should approve the pipeline with some added caveats to the bill, namely put a tariff on it, charge money coming in over our border for every barrel, use that money for infrastructure.
Okay, Michael, we appreciate your phone call. Senator Sanders?
Well, thank you, Michael. I doubt very much that the Republican sponsors of that bill, and there were a few Democrats as well, would be particularly supportive of that kind of tax. But I do agree with your point that if we had started earlier in the move to transform our energy system away from fossil fuel, we would be far ahead of where we are right now. I introduced legislation which called for 10 million solar rooftops in this country, which would be a huge boost to solar, create a whole lot of jobs, and help us move even faster. We got 40 votes on the floor of the Senate. Not bad, but obviously we've got to do more.
Let me ask you about the Keystone XL pipeline. You voted against it. The Premier of Alberta, Jim Prentice, was in Washington last month, and he made it very clear to members of Congress, hey, if you don't support the pipeline, the oil from the tar sands of Alberta are still going to get shipped to the refineries in eastern Texas, except it's going to be done by train. And we've seen some of the train accidents lately. So in a way, by defeating the pipeline, have you created a worse environmental situation?
That's what they say, Bob. And the premier is not the only person who makes that point. I'm not sure that it's true. The level of excavation and exploration that will take place has a lot to do with the price of oil. If the price of oil goes way up, maybe that's true. If it stays low, probably not. It is more expensive to transport by rail than by the pipeline. But I think the major point and the reason that I strongly oppose the Keystone pipeline is, you know, we have a president who correctly tells the world that the United States of America is concerned about climate change. And the world has got to be involved in transforming our energy system. How do we do that with a straight face when we say, okay, to a Canadian oil company, you can drill for the dirtiest oil on the planet, and we're going to make it easier for you to ship it to the Gulf Coast. So I think you just can't do that. As the previous caller indicated, I think what we've got to do is move to solar, move to wind, move to geothermal, move to biomass, and break our dependence on fossil fuel.
Let's talk to Tony in Burlington. Hey, Tony, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. My question for Senator Sanders is about higher education and making it affordable. Right now, I work with first-generation low-income high school students, helping them to get prepared for college. And one of the worst parts about my job is looking at the financial aid packages for some of my students and telling them that their dream schools aren't a reality for them because they're looking at anywhere between $40,000 and $100,000 in student loan debt. What can realistically be done to actually make college affordable for our students all across the country?
Well, Tony, thanks for that very, very important question. You asked what can realistically be done. Let me start off with telling you what should be done and then tell you that we have a Congress dominated by right-wing Republicans. So, you know, I don't know what will be done. But you put your finger on clearly one of the major issues facing this country. We live in a competitive global economy. We need the best educated workforce in the world to compete effectively. There was a time 30, 40 years ago when the United States led the world in the percentage of our people who had college degrees. Today we are in 12th place. And the reason for that is just what Tony articulated. And that is you got God knows how many hundreds of thousands of young people in this country who are saying, do I really want to go to college? These are bright kids. And they're saying, do I really want to go to college when I'm going to leave school $50,000, $80,000 in debt? And I'm going to have that debt around my neck for decades. And they don't go to college. Now, what sense is it that bright young people in this country don't go to college, don't find an easier route to the middle class, don't help us create new jobs when we're competing against countries like Germany, Scandinavia, and elsewhere, where they say, you know what? We want everybody to go to college if they have the ability and if they have the desire, and we're going to have tuition free. And in some countries, we're going to pay you to go to college. So we are working on legislation, Tony, that does two things. Number one, it will provide for free tuition, not only in the community colleges that the president is talking about, which is a step forward, but in all public colleges and universities. It'll cost us about $65 billion a year to do that. Number two, we're going to deal with this issue of student debt, which is a real, real serious problem for so many of our people. Stay tuned on that one. We should have that legislation out in a couple of weeks.
Why is the interest rate on student debt so high?
That is, originally it was because banks could make money. It was transferred to the federal government, which is a step forward. But the federal government is now in a 10-year period, Bob, making over $120 billion in profit on student loans. So I'd rather see the government make the money than the banks make the money. But the government, frankly, should not be making the money, should not be making profits off of low-income and working-class families whose crime is that they want their kids to go to college. So I think we've got to do away with that. And that's one way you can substantially lower the debt.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to John in Saxton River. Hi, John. What's on your mind today?
Hello, Mr. Saunders. What a wonderful breeze of fresh air you are. We need you. Now, I wanted to ask a question. How would you feel about some type of national service for young people in America who could not be necessarily in the military, but could be in work in hospitals or nursing homes or on farms or in the forests or whatever? How do you feel about that?
Well, I'll tell you, John, that is a very interesting idea, and I haven't given it, you know, a definitive thought process. I think it's a good idea, and it's an idea that should be explored for two reasons. Number one, youth unemployment, and we don't talk about that at all. Bob, you tell me, how much discussion have you heard? You follow these things on youth unemployment.
Every once in a while, you hear that that youth unemployment is very high.
But not a whole lot of serious discussion about it, I think. Anyhow, it's about 18%, okay? African-American youth unemployment, significantly higher than that. So I think that John raises an interesting issue. When you have over 5 million young people in this country who have either dropped out of high school or graduated high school and don't have any jobs, I think what John is saying, hey, let's put these young people to work. Let's help them with their education. I think that makes a lot of sense. So I don't have a definitive plan on that yet, John, but I think it is an idea absolutely worth exploring.
Today on the program, our guest is Senator Bernie Sanders. Our phone number is 1-800-639-2211. This is Vermont Edition on VPR. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinsel. Our guest today, Senator Bernie Sanders. Our phone number, 1-800-639-2211. Let's talk to Ron in Rutland. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good afternoon, Bob and Senator Sanders. Quick question or suggestions regarding the war resolution, you know, relating to ISIS, I guess. One is the 28, I guess there's like 28 pages that were redacted or withheld from the public from the 9/11 report, and I think they have to do with Saudi Arabia. I think that should be like an amendment to make that known if we are going to do this, because we really don't know what we're fighting for. You know, I mean, the American public, you know, thought it was WMD, and we don't really know what it's for. Secondly, if we're going to start another war, which I hope we don't, but if we do, there should be a war tax, because we should not be borrowing from Social Security or anywhere else. If we're going to do this, let's, you know, put it out on the table and have a tax, a war tax for it. Otherwise, you know, these so-called fiscal conservatives, you know, they're just calling themselves that. They're not really conservative.
Okay, Ron, thanks very much for your phone call. I think the Foreign Relations Committee is going to start taking up the president's plan for military authorization. Will you support that?
No, not the president's language. No, I won't. Ron raises a lot of very important issues. You know, we went into the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the assumption, and we have the quotes from all the Bush people, these are going to be easy wars. We're going to get in, we're going to get out, we're going to restore peace and democracy to the Middle East. Well, you know what? Didn't quite happen that way. And I think, you know, what Ron is maybe suggesting is there are unintended consequences when you go into war. And again, as the former chairman of the Veterans Committee, I can tell you the cost of war. And it's not just the 6,700 brave people that we lost in those wars. It's the 500,000 that came back with PTSD and TBI and trillions of dollars that were spent. So I am very, very reluctant and very much opposed to getting us into still another war in that region. One raises the issue of Saudi Arabia. Let me just say this because it's an important issue. And he raised it in a different way. People don't know this, Bob, but Saudi Arabia, turns out, has the third largest defense budget, military budget of any country on earth, bigger than the UK, bigger than France. I find it a little bit absurd that the leaders of Saudi Arabia, this is a billionaire family that runs the country, literally is telling the president of the United States, we want you, America, to pay for a war, to send your young people into battle to protect us. Well, if Saudi Arabia has the third largest military budget on earth, and if ISIS is functioning a few miles away from Saudi Arabia, maybe they might want to put their troops on the ground. Maybe they might want to pay for that war. ISIS is a terrible terrorist organization. They must be defeated, and we should be involved in that process, supporting Muslim countries who have troops on the ground taking on ISIS. Saudi army, much larger, much, much larger than ISIS. Let them get involved. And I think Ron's idea about a war tax, exactly right. My Republican colleagues want to cut Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, because we have this deficit, and yet they're willing to go to war and add that to the credit card. I think that's wrong. So I think Ron's idea about a war tax is a very good one.
Now, you support airstrikes, military airstrikes, yes, in that part of the country. What if that turns out to be not enough?
Well, I think the answer is that the people who have got to lead that war, short-term and long-term, are the Muslim countries. And I'll tell you why, Bob. It's not only that we should not be fighting Saudi Arabia's battle. This is the war going on in their neighborhood. But you got billionaire families running Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait. You got Jordan sitting there. And at the end of the day, it's not only who is doing the fighting. It is the question of the war for the soul of Islam. And I think that America coming in there and leading the effort somehow works to the advantage of ISIS, who say, we're fighting this Christian nation. We're fighting American imperialism. It is important that the Muslim nations lead that effort with our support, and the support, by the way, of Western Europe.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Eva, who is calling from New Haven. Hey, Eva, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to state that I feel the recent actions of the members of the Senate that wrote the open letter to Iran is, in my opinion, treasonous. We don't dirty our own nest, as the Germans like to say. It's going to come back to haunt them someday, and I laud Senator Sanders for not stooping to their level and using those types of tactics. And we would totally support him if he ran for president. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Senator, what did you think when you saw that letter signed by 47 members of the U.S. Senate?
I mean, it's really amazing and it's incomprehensible. Here you have a situation where we've been through two painful wars. Bob, I have gone to too many funerals in the state of Vermont for wonderful young people who lost their lives in those wars. And I don't want to go to more funerals. And I don't want to see us spending trillions of dollars. I want to see the president do everything that he can, working, by the way, not alone. He's working with the UK, working with France, working with Germany, working with Russia, working with China. That's a tough coalition. To come together to say to Iran, Iran, you know what? You are not going to get a nuclear weapon. We have sanctions against you. The international community does. And you got to not build a nuclear weapon. That's what the president is trying to do. He's trying to get Iran not to have a nuclear weapon and do it in a way that doesn't require a war, which would be a terrible thing. And then you have these guys, these 47 Republicans who are lecturing the Ayatollah there. I mean, they have a split country there. They have hardliners who no doubt welcome this letter. So they're going to say to the negotiators, see, we told you all along the United States doesn't really want an agreement. They just want war with Iran. So I think that is just counterproductive, and it just continues. Getting to another area, the contempt that many of these Republicans have for President Obama, they literally have almost not acknowledged the fact that he won two elections. They refused to give him his legitimacy. President of the United States, Democrat or Republican, is the person who leads us in foreign policy. You don't sabotage that effort, especially when he is trying to bring about a peaceful solution to a very difficult issue.
If the Obama administration does reach a compromise and an agreement with the government of Iran, Do you think that that deal has to be approved by the U.S. Senate?
Well, it's not for certain. It depends on the nature of the agreement. I think, you know, he has already started a process and has sanctions which did not get the support of the United States Senate. Bottom line for me, Bob, is I say this reluctantly, not happy to say it, but there are some folks who think that the only solution to international problems is war. And I just, that bothers me, it hurts me. It's just, we've got to figure out a way, and it's difficult out there. God only knows it's difficult. But to undermine the president who is trying, you know, I know John Kerry. John was, you know, I talked to John a few weeks ago. I mean, these people are working 24/7 under very difficult circumstances trying to come up with a solution. Give them a chance. Give them a chance to succeed.
Right at the top of the program, you mentioned the Pacific Rim trade agreement. Years ago, you were very much against the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, as it was known. Is it basically the same concerns with this Trans-Pacific Partnership?
It is the same and more. And I will let the listeners and the American people make a judgment whether I was right or whether I was wrong. Yes, I did oppose NAFTA. I did oppose the Central American Free Trade Agreement. I did oppose normalizing trade relations with China, free trade with China. And I voted against, I think, every major trade agreement. Was I right? Was I wrong? Well, I think history will suggest that I was strongly right. Since 2001, Bob, we have lost 60,000 factories in this country. I think, I could be wrong on this, I think the last 6 or 7 years, 25% of Vermont's manufacturing jobs have disappeared. We have lost millions of jobs nationally. We are now in a race to the bottom with China, where companies are very proud to say, see, I can pay American workers low wages because they don't have a choice. Either they accept lower wages, lower health care benefits, or else I move to China. What a great position for me as a CEO of a major corporation. So I do not want to see a continuation of a policy which I think has failed. Is trade a good thing? Yes. But we need trade agreements that work for the middle class and working families of this country and not just the CEOs of large corporations.
And is it likely that this trade agreement is going to come to the Senate and it's an up or down vote? Yes, no, no amendments? Is that the way this is going to work?
Well, the way it works, there are two parts of it, Bob. The first part is what is called trade authority, fast track. And what fast track is about is, in fact, no amendments and requires 50 votes. And what I fear is that, furthermore, what a problem we're having with the trade representative is we can't get good information about giving the president the authority. What's in the agreement? Well, so there have been some leaks, which suggests to me that this is a bad agreement. But fast track, you're right in saying, by law, does not allow for any amendments, an up or down vote.
We've got about a minute left. What are your thoughts about raising the federal gasoline tax in order to put money in the Highway Trust Fund?
As we discussed earlier, our roads and our bridges are falling they're crumbling. And we need a huge investment to rebuild our infrastructure. The gas tax, per se, is not a fair tax for rural states like Vermont, because we have people listening to this program who will travel, you know, many, many hundreds of miles a week to get to work and come home. And I don't want those people to be taxed. I think the way you bring in the revenue that we need is to go after those wealthier individuals and large corporations who are not paying their fair share of taxes. If some kind of compromise can be reached, which may be reached, which maybe combines both elements, you know, it's something that I would take a look at.
Well, we've certainly discussed a lot of important issues today on the program. Senator Bernie Sanders, many thanks for being on the program.
My pleasure, Bob. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today. Monday on Vermont Edition, it's the 50th anniversary of The Sound of Music, opening in theaters across America. We'll learn why this film has become a favorite for generations of families. We'll also hear from the author of a new book about the movie and from a Von Trapp family member who will discuss how realistic the movie was in portraying the family's experiences. Send your questions or comments about The Sound of Music to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen Monday at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Sengary, and Steve Zind. We have production assistance from Devin Karambolis. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Bob Kinzel. Have a great weekend.